2000 AD, 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. Growing Rebellion. Borak Thung, Earthlitz, and welcome to a supplemental episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. At the beginning of February, we had a fantastically successful 40th anniversary event, and it was an incredible day. Over 1,000 Squatstick Thargo, over 100 creators, all crammed into the Novotel in Hammersmith in London for a day of panels and signings and sketchings and just general fun. And all the feedback we've had has been absolutely wonderful. So thank you to everybody who came. Now, we appreciate that not everybody could get tickets, so we thought we would bring the event to you. So in between episodes of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, we're going to be bringing you panels recorded at the 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. Now, it's been 4 decades since 2000 AD blazed into the thriller sphere, and 17 since it was bought by Rebellion. The owners, Jason and Chris Kingsley, did a great panel at the 40 Years of Thrill Power Festival about their reasons behind buying 2000 AD, what they've done with it over the last 17 years, how they've created a fantastic foundation to go forward into the 21st century, and what their plans are for the galaxy's greatest comic after its 40th anniversary. They're joined by Ben Smith, who's the head of books and comic book publishing, and a previous guest on the 2000 AD Thrillcast. And your host for Growing Rebellion is me, Michael Malsher. Hello, everybody, and welcome to second panel, just by 15 minutes, of 2000 AD 40th anniversary event. Are you all happy to be here?
Yes. Yes. Hey.
Sorry, no. You're going to have to be more enthusiastic about that. It's one day, for goodness sake. Are you happy to be here?
Yes!
That's better, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I'm vibrating on a slightly different frequency to everybody else at the moment. So, welcome to the Growing Rebellion panel. Hopefully, you'll learn something a bit about the business, not just of 2000 AD, but of our parent company, Rebellion. And I'm absolutely delighted to welcome onto the panel owners of 2000 AD and Rebellion, Chris and Jason Kingsley.
Hello. Hello. I'm Jason.
I'm Chris. Can you hear that? Okay. Can you hear me okay? You
might need to turn up Chris's mic a little bit.
The orangey one.
Yep, cool.
Thank you.
And also our head of books and comic books, Mr. Ben Smith. Yay! And I'm Malchar, but you know that already. I am going to sit down, I'm afraid, so for some of you I will disappear. So Jason and Chris, let's talk a little bit about your... how Rebellion came to be, because it remains one of the biggest independent games developers in the UK. Tell us a bit about how Rebellion came to be, and also how it's grown.
Do you want to take this? Or
we'll both do it. I mean, it started out, we managed to make computer games, didn't we? We did some freelance work as a student. You were doing art, I did some programming. I mean, we've only got an hour, well, actually, even less than that, so this could take a long, long, long time. But we started out,
it's a freelance work,
summer job
while I was doing my zoology degree. And but both of us played games and read comics. I mean, I am a reader of 2000 AD. I bought issue one from the news agents next to the chip shop, which is on the way back from school. Yeah. So
Shep Shed.
I think the Space Spinner ended up that afternoon on my gran's garage roof, which didn't have a convenient access point to get back to it.
Actually, it was worse than that, because it was in our gran's back yard, but actually, because there was a field behind it, and we remember it went over into the cornfield.
Oh, there you go. You see, it's all a long time ago, of course. But, so as fans of 2000 AD, we'd kind of grown up as readers. The computer games company was expanding. We were working with other people's brands. We did a lot of work with Electronic Arts and The Simpsons. We did James Bond game, Aliens versus Predator.
Star Wars.
A whole lot of big brands. But we really wanted to work on creating our own games. And also, I had a sneaky suspicion that 2000 AD was kind of having some difficulties or not really loved in the way it should be.
That was going to be my next question, how did you come to buy it? Because it seems an odd thing. Two guys who own a computer game firm going, you know what?
Is that it? Is that
time's over,
up?
Right.
That went really quickly. Yeah. Right.
it's like Heidi High, isn't it? How did you find out that 2000 AD was in any way, shape, or form up for sale? And B, why did you decide to buy it? Because you don't have a background in publishing.
No. Well, it wasn't up for sale. I wanted to make a Strontium Dog game, so I approached Egmont in the UK and said I'd really like to license Strontium Dog to make a computer game, and they said we don't do that, which I thought was a very curious thing for anybody to say. Like, here's some money, go and make some cool stuff with it. I thought that wasn't a satisfactory answer, and I then did a bit of commercial digging into it, worked out that in fact, the reason for it was that the UK company didn't have the rights. So they couldn't license it. It wasn't that they didn't want to. It was that they couldn't. They didn't have the power. It was actually owned by a Danish company. The whole structure had been bought by a company called Egmont. Very, very good sort of, it's called a foundation. It's sort of part charity, part business based in Denmark.
Part owned by the Danish government.
Part owned by the Danish government. They pay very low taxes as well. So they have quite a lot of spare money. They acquired the Egmont group to get the Disney license, because they wanted to unify the Disney license. This is getting quite complicated, I know. They wanted to unify the Disney license. 2000 AD came kicking and screaming with that purchase. But the other problem was the Disney license, and this is only a guess, but every time I've said it to anybody that licenses from Disney, they lose blood in their face and they go pale. Disney has some very draconian parts in its contract which say, if you do anything in your business which could damage the Disney brand, we'll pull the plug on you. And we can do that because we're Disney and we're massively powerful. I don't know that that's true, but anybody I've spoken to that works with Disney kind of looks pained because it is true. Now, the problem was they had 2000 AD, which was successful and sort of chugging along, but they couldn't be seen to promote it because that might be seen to promote this sort of punky, kind of irreverent, sort of future-looking, sarcastic, difficult brand, as they would see it, when you're dealing with
the awkward teenager.
Yeah, the awkward teenager.
When you're dealing with not a teenager anymore, but yeah.
Yeah. When you're dealing with Twinkle Toes Princess and My Furry Bunny comics, you know, the 2000 AD stands out, quite frankly. So I made a presentation to them. I flew to Denmark and made a presentation and said to them, you've got a problem. And they kind of looked at me in a sort of slightly strange Danish way and said, how do you know? And I said, well, we've put two and two together and we've come up with six, and this is how we're going to solve the problem for you. And to cut a long story short, 2 years of negotiations with lawyers and accountants trying to structure a deal, we ended up acquiring the whole thing. It took a lot of grit and determination to do it, and a lot of times we were told no. But the end result was we managed to kind of, in some ways I see it, yes, technically it's a purchase, but in some ways I see it as a rescue mission. We kind of rescued 2000 AD from owners that kind of didn't appreciate it for what it was, and perhaps couldn't appreciate it for what it was because of the business structure. So,
but also, I think they didn't really see the potential.
Yes.
That's something that we always thought. We thought there's a lot of potential there. There's some incredible stories and characters that were just sort of not really ignored, but just as underappreciated. And we thought there was a lot of people out there that would love to read the stories if we could just get it to them.
And I still, it's very cool to be able to do the joke when you introduce yourself to somebody they don't know and you say, oh yes, I bought 2000 AD, and they go, oh yeah, I bought it on Saturday as well. And every time I tell that joke, it just gives me a little jolt of happiness, in a big way. So that's the story, really. So it does fit alongside the Rebellion brand in many ways. It sits alongside what we do in computer games. But we run it as a separate organization. It's not supported by computer games. It's a sister company. It's run by its own very talented team of people. And we pretty much leave it alone. I still read the comic. I still don't read ahead. That was very tempting, I'll tell you. You know, it's really good to be, you know, I could probably read about six weeks ahead, 8 weeks ahead. I don't know how long, probably a bit more than that. But I still read it when it comes out.
For me, actually, the probably the best bit is that we bought 2000 AD in 2000, so I can automatically remember when we bought it. Because otherwise, because actually it's quite hard. You start looking back and going, when did we start? Because Rebellion started in, what, 92? So Rebellion's been around for a good long time.
Rebellion celebrates its 25th birthday later this year, doesn't it?
Yes, it's in December this year. Yeah,
yeah. Things have changed quite profoundly since you were, you know, essentially a work for hire developer. We're now at a stage where what's the term one of the guys used in the office? Kind of a produced, like a publisher developer.
Yes, we
prefer developer publisher. We prefer that emphasis.
We fund our own games with our own money, with our own retained profits. We put that money back in, and we publish our own games now. So we don't have many people to blame if things go wrong anymore. So that's the sort of it's a good place to be. It's a little bit more risky, I suppose, but I don't think it is risky because we will only make stuff that we like to play or read, and you can do as much market research as you like, but at the end of the day, if you're making something you believe in and you like it and you like the content, and not every story is my favorite story, not every game we make is my favorite game, but if you enjoy what you do, you're in a much stronger place, I think.
One thing I want to know is about that early period after you bought it, because 2008 was in not great shape at the time. It had been through a lot of changes, a lot of challenges. You guys come along after 2 years of negotiation, you buy it. There's a transition period where it's still based in the London office before moving to Oxford. And then there's a few years where, now you know, we've got a bigger team than we've ever had. But there were certain decisions and certain deals made. It felt at the time very much like you were feeling your way through a new industry.
We were a blind man in a dark room, you know, when it came to comic publishing. But we had some skilled people there by pure coincidence, with the coincidence of 2000 AD. Andy Diggle took over almost to the day when we completed the deal in a sort of surprising coincidence, which if you tried to plan it wouldn't have ever happened. But Bishop had decided to move on, hand over the reins to Andy. And, you know, Andy was then our new publisher. So to a certain extent, everybody was, you know, he obviously done a lot of editing, but he hadn't been the editor before, and we hadn't been the owners before. And I think one of the things we wanted to do is not interfere too much and kind of leave it and work out what we wanted to do going forward.
Which is something you never hear from a new owner. You know what, I'll just let you get on with it. That nobody says that. They said, can you maybe this? And
well, I do often come up and say, hey, here's a good idea. How about,
I think the biggest issue for us was with a weekly cadence, you know, having to publish every week. You know, if you miss that deadline, it's not like it's monthly where you can kind of squeeze a few days here or there. You know, if you miss it going off to publishing, if you miss it going off to print, you'll miss an issue, and you'll note we haven't missed an issue. So doing anything with 2008, physically moving it, takes preparation, because the editorial team have got to prep for the move. They know that everything is going to be disturbed for a week while you know new computers are, software's reinstalled and that kind of stuff. So they sort of have to get ahead of themselves, and getting ahead of yourself in a weekly schedule is actually quite difficult to do. So all credit to those the team, which is bigger now. They do a very good job, but they have to be quite looking forwards into the future to hit that weekly schedule.
Cool. That's ironic.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the 2080 games that Rebellion has published, Dread versus Death and Rogue Trooper. It seems obvious that you would make a Judge Dredd game, but what was your decision-making process behind specifically going for the Dread versus Death idea?
We were very keen on making a Dread game. The problem with Dread for people that aren't readers of 2000 AD and don't understand it is, especially in North America, they immediately go, oh, that Stallone movie. They don't anymore, thank goodness, but for a long time they go, oh, you want to make a game of the Stallone movie, do you? Why do you want to do that? And then you end up on the back foot entirely. So we did find the right partners there to work with. It was quite hard work, actually. It was a harder sell than I thought to kind of get the funding in. Those were the days when we were work for hire. And if those of you don't understand the work for hire model, what happens is you pitch an idea to somebody, they will then, and you then negotiate how much you're going to get paid before the thing's finished. Then you deliver the thing on a monthly basis, usually, and you get paid monthly. And then at the end of it, if you're lucky, you might get some royalties or some profits or whatever. So the work for hire model for computer games development is quite an old school one, and we don't do it anymore.
And you normally would have to sign the IP over, wouldn't you? Which, of course, we were never going to do that with Dread.
Yeah. So you end up with, we'd love the Judge Dread game. Fantastic. We'd like to own Judge Dread. No, you can't. So you get into that difficult situation where there's no way we're going to sell the characters, or we just don't do that ever. We do license stuff to people, but we want to maintain the catalog, the library, the coherency of it. It would be horrible to sort of sell things away from the 2000 AD family. That just isn't something we do. It's a red line when we're in negotiations with other people, and I presume you're going to ask us about some of the other stuff in due course.
No spoilers. but with Dread, I mean, I'll be frank. Please don't fire me. It's a game that's not aged well. Whereas a game like
Harsh, but possibly
well, no, fair. Because it's very much of its time in terms of the technology that was available to you. But something like Rogue Trooper was not only innovative for its time, it still plays well, and it still has an awful lot of fans. What was the difference between those two points for you?
I think the biggest problem with Dread, the Dread versus Death game, we didn't sell the idea that you weren't going around shooting everybody. And a lot of computer games, the audience expects you to go around shooting everything that moves.
Yes, it was a shooter where you don't shoot.
Yeah, it was a shooter where you arrest and you challenge. And I think that was quite a difficult mechanism explanation to people about how a game was played. So I think it sort of fell a little bit between two stools there. I
mean, sometimes you, when you're making games, it's sometimes kind of what you find is your greatest strength, which is kind of the core, the essence of the character or the story, then actually becomes a bit of a millstone. I mean, for example, on Sniper Elite, well, it's a sniping game, but of course that then becomes a problem. Technically, you have to have very large distances and long distances, which means you can't necessarily get the fidelity up close. So that means you're fighting the frame rate. So actually, it is... You often make fundamental decisions right at the start of when you're making a game that actually you don't really understand the ramifications just till it's crunch time.
I think the fundamentals of Rogue were more obvious as well. I think the one we actually got challenged with is, what do we do with Helm? What gameplay component can Helm have? And that was a sort
of... He levitates. What are you talking about?
Well, I know. We're games makers, not writers. So we could have come up with lots of things. Little legs come out the side and he runs around. It was kind of clear. We wanted Rogue to be challenged. And therefore, in some ways, when you challenge a character, you sort of almost have to take away the props and the powers that he has. You'll note that if anybody's ever writing a story about Superman, they have to depower Superman and he becomes just man. And that then becomes interesting, except he's no longer super. So you get a little bit of recursive storytelling there. But with Rogue, we also wanted to take Gunarm, Bagman, and Helm away and have to kind of recapture them as well. And I think we actually, in some ways, lucked out on a very solid gameplay mechanic there. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But Rogue was a little bit further on in our technology as well, and a little bit better frame rate possibilities and a little bit better graphics.
Well, yeah, you could say with Dread is we were pushing all the boundaries in terms of what their hardware could do. And then with Rogue, we'd learnt a lot more. Because actually, when you start doing stuff on consoles, probably your first game, you're maybe using, 30 to 40% of the overall power of a console. Then the next one, maybe using 60 to 70. It's only actually when you get your sort of third generation game on a console that you really can actually get to near 100% of the power. And then, of course, you're on to the next generation. It's just like, oh, God.
Start again.
Also, crowds are very expensive to do on a computer. And the one thing Megacity One needs is crowds. And that's the one thing you can't really do. So it's a little bit of a catch-22 situation. New Earth, with the fog and the chem clouds and the poisons, they're brilliant because you can sort of fog in the distance and you can say it's chem clouds. And nobody knows it's because you need a draw distance that's closer. Yeah, well, they actually know that.
But there's an army just over that hill,
yes,
honestly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In the fog, and then things can loom out of the fog. So, yeah, I think probably Rogue was an easier fit for a computer game, actually. Dredd's quite a complex character, and the sort of policing action is more nuanced than a war action. You have to be a bit subtler when you're arresting citizens than you can if you're just shooting everything with the gun.
Well, to a certain extent with Dredd, even when he is running around shooting, just shooting people, there's still lots of other elements going on there, which kind of, that's what makes the comic so nuanced and so interesting and so enjoyable to read. But when it's a straightforward shooter on a computer game, you kind of don't want to put too many distractions in, I guess.
We could go into, I've done whole lectures on storytelling in computer games and stuff, and it's probably not the forum for it, but telling a story in a computer game is quite difficult and quite different than telling a story in a book or a comic book or a feature film, for example, or a television series. You have to rely on the player to engage their actions as well, and they have to part tell the story and fill in the gaps. The problem with a computer game is your timing relies entirely upon the skill and the thumbs and fingers and the ability of your player to solve the problems and to sort of move through the story. And quite often I've played computer games and I'm 3 hours in and I haven't got a clue what I'm actually supposed to be doing apart from finishing the level or something, and I don't know what the story is. And if I do that, and I'm kind of steeped in computer games, I imagine other people do that as well. So you get very drawn out storytelling in computer games, and you're right, I think Dredd's world is actually harder to engage with as an interactive thing than Rogue's world is, perhaps. Maybe the Rogue story is simpler. It's a journey, and that fits really well with the computer game.
It's also an element of the kind of where we were in the technology at the time. There's only so much you could do. Now, you can't simulate a sort of a mega city one in the, you know, with that technology that was around there.
It was probably a little overambitious, I would say. And I think Rogue worked really well. We got really good reviews, really good sales. And yeah, that was exciting too.
There was a classic line from one of the publishers, wasn't it? Well, actually, there was two. Yeah. There was one which was, games with blue characters don't sell, do they? And you replied, what you mean apart from Sonic the Hedgehog and the Smurfs?
Yeah.
And, which are, in fact, the only games with blue characters said,
well,
we can think of.
He said, yes, well, absolutely, yeah, apart from those two. And I said, what other blue characters are there? He said, well, Rogue's blue, and that sold really well. I mean, so all three blue characters have sold really well, and you're drawing from that the fact that blue characters don't sell. That's why his company didn't do very well for very long.
Since Rogue Trooper, the only time Rebellion has used the IP has been the Dredd versus Zombies game on for mobile devices. Can we talk about potential for the future? Because there isn't a day goes by that somebody doesn't tweet the 2080 Twitter account saying, why don't you do Grand Theft Auto?
That's
Legacy
why we've
one?
Employed you.
Yeah, yeah, thanks for that.
You have to take that. The problem is simply bandwidth. We are a very big independent games developer. We've got well over 200 full-time members of staff work for us. And I want to do more 2080 games. I say that publicly, and then we just don't find the space in the studio to do it. The Sniper Elite series is hugely successful for us and sells worldwide. And the Zombie Army spin-offs of that, the Battlezone VR opportunity that we did recently with Sony for their Sony VR system has just filled us chock-a-block. However, we have decided that we need to address that. And so what we're going to do this year, we are announcing here that we are going to open up the library of intellectual property, the characters, the stories, to good quality independent games makers and try to engage the community of games makers with the sort of fantastic library of of characters we've got. So we're inviting people to actually ask us, can we do a Dread World game? Can we do Hell Trekkers? Can we do a Zombo game? So we're hoping that, and we're slightly formalizing this as well, so we're sort of saying, yes, we are now open for these kind of pitches. So I think we're doing a press release about that sometime in the future, aren't we?
Or? We will be doing, yes.
Oh, right.
Sort of, say Monday.
Right,
Monday,
okay.
We're back in the office. Yeah.
Yeah, so that should be very exciting because there are an awful lot of voices out there that would love to work with what we've got. And we are not sitting on things preventing people from doing it. We just haven't had time. So, and we're not likely to have time in the next, realistically, the next few years, perhaps. I don't know. I always say that, and then it doesn't happen.
Never say never.
Yeah. But there are a lot of very talented games makers out there who would love to play with some of the stuff we've got. So we want to make sure the deals are fair, the characters are protected and looked after, the quality is kept high. But there'll be different ways of telling stories in the interactive space, and that's very exciting for us. And as we grow as a company, we've got structures in place, people like Ben involved in licensing and Mike involved in sort of community building and that kind of stuff. We've got enough people around us that can look after that. So, yeah, you heard it here first.
Excellent. let's talk about the other thing that we get tweeted at a lot, which
oh,
is
Lord.
About not just a sequel to Dread, but also you know why there aren't 2080 movies and TV series.
I'll take this one as well. Yeah,
yeah. Jason has to deal with all the shitty people.
There are people online that speculate wildly. About
really?
Way.
No.
There are a couple
think,
of.
I think it's just the same person.
Yeah. There's a couple of strong characters that will. Yeah. We are working in the background on trying to get stuff done in both film and TV spaces. I won't go into any more details than that, but we do have some full-time members of staff who are working on that in that space. The problem is that the contracts and the deals that Hollywood want to sign are...
Shit.
I didn't say it.
Yeah.
They are very aggressive, and I am not willing to hand over the ABC Warriors to Warner Brothers to just punt something out there so that they can do whatever they like with it with no controls whatsoever and potentially damage it or do something that we don't like. So we get numerous inquiries all the time about stuff, and we almost always, first of all, we're fairly open about that. We say, so tell us what you've done. A lot of people haven't done anything before, so there's no way they're going to get a chance to work with our stuff unless they bring something more serious to the table. If they are serious players, and these come up all the time, we then tell them what our red lines are, which is the characters. For example, imagine Rogue Trooper. Rogue Trooper has to be non-human colored. He has to be blue. He doesn't have to necessarily be turquoise, but he has to be blue. He has to have odd eyes. He has to be in New Earth. You know, we can't have a Rogue Trooper game in another setting. That just wouldn't be Rogue Trooper. So we put these red lines in place, and then a lot of the time Hollywood says, oh, we'll just give you some more money. And we go, no, no, it's not about that. It's about protecting the legacy of the 2080 characters. We worked very hard with DNA to make sure that Dredd didn't take his helmet off. He didn't have a love affair. You know, he didn't chuck his badge on the desk of his sergeant and say, I quit. You know, he isn't a rogue cop on the edge. You know, you'd be surprised how many people pitch us these things. And we fight against them all the time. We just reject them. So Chris and my perspective on this is that whilst we technically are the owners of 2000 AD, we are in fact the guardians of it. And it matters to us as readers and fans that we do things well. I actually think it's better to do a few things well than a lot of things badly. And it's very frustrating. It's incredibly frustrating when you actually are in negotiations with people and you say, you can't own that character. And they say, oh, it's okay, we'll just license it for 25 years with a 25-year renewal automatic clause. And they don't say they're going to do anything. They just want to license
the classic one. They say, "Oh, we want to keep the video game and the comic rights, comic book rights."
Yes, yeah, they say that, and they say, "Wouldn't it be really embarrassing if, for example, you had a license to a video game, you gave it to one of our competitors, and they made a crap video game out of it? How are we going to square that with you guys as fans? You know, if somebody comes up with a really bad video game of one of our characters that we haven't been involved with?" So we, more often than not, when we do get to any kind of negotiation stage, we end up rejecting the contract and walking away because it's just not right. And that's, we think that's the right way to go.
Well, I think it's important that 2008 has never compromised. The history of 2008 is not compromising. And you know, the one time it did compromise, we got the Stallone movie. So, you know,
yeah, that was before our time. You know, I would not have let that happen. And DNA, to be fair to those guys, were very good. And I have to say, Carl Urban was very good. And Carl and I have talked quite a lot about it. And he agrees with me. He wouldn't have taken the role on if he'd taken the helmet off, which is great. But you'd be surprised, unless you have it written down in black and white in Hollywood, whatever it says is that whatever they say is about as much as they will ever give you. So you have to be really careful with the contracts, because they basically, let's face it, it's an industry that sells tinsel to people. You know, it's an industry based on smoke and mirrors, and their lawyers are quite powerful and well paid.
I did like the story you told me about negotiations for a Rogue Trooper film, where at the last minute, just before you were due to sign, they came back and went, "Does he have to be blue?" Yeah. And you went, "Yes, he has to be blue. Well, can his veins not just be blue? Veins are blue."
Yeah, I've had some very surreal conversations. Yeah, a lot of them are covered by non-disclosure agreements as well, because again, Hollywood's a bit like that. But you'd be surprised how utterly insane some people who outwardly look sane are.
I want to move beyond the games and the TV stuff, and actually come to Ben, because last year we took possession of, well, the stablemates of 2000 AD from the 1970s and 80s.
You're pretty much half of the comic book industry from 1970 onwards.
Yeah, so the IPC Fleetway archive, I know there's a lot of people who are very excited about what we're going to be drawing out of this for our first series of reprints. We're not going to tell you yet. But explain a little bit about, number one, why we did this, and number two, what our plans are for the future.
Well, I think the seeds of it were sown quite a long time ago in lots of different ways. I think knowing that we'd clearly got what was everybody perceived as the single greatest British comic in 2008, and we got the Judge Dredd magazine as well, which, you know, the two go hand in hand. And by the year 2000, the only comic left running from its stablemates was Buster, and that was soon to close as well. So all the other, and the narrative of the last 40 years has been, because 2008 is so different, was so revolutionary, was in many ways so much better than so many of these other comics, it became the story. And, you know, Charlie's War, of course, it was maybe the one exception, and Battle the other exception, that was the comic that people also knew existed, but wasn't really there. But then, I'll be honest with you, I joined Rebellion in about 2009 and got to spend 8 hours, or probably 10 hours, on a plane next to Pat Mills within 6 months, which was a dream come true for me. But Pat was in that talking about girls' comics and talking about Misty and things that were really good, and he was quite passionate about that. And I confess, I didn't know anything about Misty at the time. And so that kind of sowed the seed of starting talking about things. And then as years progressed and we got 2000 AD launched in America with our book list there, and then the movie came out and we became one of the, you know, top five best-selling graphic novel imprints in the country. 2000 AD became the number one best-selling comic on the newsstand again in its category. And then, you know, so all those boxes got ticked over the last kind of 6 or 7 years. And then always niggling in the back of one's head was, well, you know, there's that Misty thing. And then Keith Richardson, the graphic novels editor for Rebellion, said, you know what, there's this lost Alan Moore, John Wagner, Alan Grant collaboration. You know what? And I find it strange that it took, you know, us, it took anybody 30 years to go, wow, so there's a John Wagner, Alan Grant, Alan Moore book that's never been published. I wonder what we could do with that. And so basically, I went to Egmont and said, oh, well, you know, I'd like to license Misty and I'd like to license that. And we'll just, you know, well, let's dip our toe in the water. And those are things that are famous for creators who work for 2000 AD. That'll be easy and that'll be straightforward. And then I got to know Egmont a little bit and realised that their business, as Jason was saying, is Disney. And it's Star Wars now, and it's Marvel, and it's massive franchises. And they have this enormous archive of comics, and the licensing of them was a pain in the ass for them, basically. You know, they every time somebody wanted something that they hadn't previously licensed, which mostly was Battle, it was like, well, when did that come out? Where is that? You know, and do we have a copy of that somewhere? Can you do all the work? And basically, it was just for the money, because nobody was publishing a large list of books, it wasn't worth their time or effort. And we know from 15 years of curating the backlist of 2000 AD, what the riches are in kind of, you know, these decades worth of comics. And so just basically alarm bells started ringing to say, you know what, in the same way I think you got the sense of it in the 90s, you know, this stuff is available, this stuff is up there. Well, they weren't looking to sell it, but then as we started the conversation, it began incrementally. So, well, maybe we could just take Scream and Misty off your hands. And then
you start gently when you're trying to do something like this. You're extracting something that you think is incredibly valuable from somebody. They actually think of it as a load of hassle. But if they get wind that you think it's very valuable, suddenly they won't give it to you, or they won't sell it to you. So it's another business sort of, you have to be a bit careful. You can't be too enthusiastic, even though you really want to go, oh, brilliant.
There was that moment where we were having a lunch with them, and I said, well, you know, so actually, you know what, let's broaden this out. I'll tell you, you know, let's look at the girls' comics, which is the thing I've been most excited about, getting hold of these. And then the gentleman across the table said, how do you feel about Roy the Rovers? To which my reaction was, no. Well, I'll see. I'm not sure. I went straight back and said, yeah.
And I said, yeah. Please, please, yeah, go ahead.
And so from there, it was basically, you know, there's also the intangible thing of, therefore, what price do you put on? I'm not going to tell you what the price was. But what price you put on these things, because they'd made no money out of them for a long time. But there's the perceived value, there's the real value, and there's the actual value of what you may be able to achieve over time.
And there's the hassle value as well. If you're not going to pay them something that's worth, that kind of makes them go, oh, okay, that'll make my quarters kind of numbers look better, that's brilliant. They can't be bothered because it is a load of hassle, and they could just leave stuff in the basement, mouldering away, not being exploited, not being published, not being read for ages. So you have to structure a deal that kind of works practically, and that they're okay with, and secretly quite pleased with, because I think they were secretly quite pleased with it.
I can tell you that the gentleman whose job it was to license all that stuff is over the moon that he doesn't have to do that anymore. And I'm over the moon because I get to do it all now. And the amazing thing is, basically, once we said, you know what, let's just take it all. Let's just do everything.
Let's simplify your life for you.
Exactly. Yeah. And the journey, therefore, that I've been on over the last 12, 18 months, 2 years, along with Keith, is just discovering the creators, the careers, the characters, the strips that I wasn't aware of. You know, I was a 2000 AD reader from the start, and that was me. And I, you know, and instead, just to discover this incredible world of, I mean, we had to install 90 linear meters of shelving in the office to take the red bound volumes of comic books. I think I had to calculate it by length, but I think we've got like 600,000 pages of strip that came with this archive. And
that's on top of all the stuff we've got.
And that's on top of all the stuff we've already got. Basically, we're in a large open plan office, which is now walled off where you get to the publishing section by all these books. So what we've discovered is, and what we will be announcing shortly, are the things we're starting to produce from them. Rebellion, I think, is justly famous for the quality of the Reaper graphics work that we do in our editions, that we try and make them really better than they have ever appeared before, because they've gone crap paper and things like that. The job we have with this archive is far harder than with 2000 AD. With 2000 AD, we acquired a lot of film. The paper later in the, you know, after the start, got better. Whereas the stuff we're looking at is atrocious in many ways.
Weren't we using some artificial intelligence algorithms to deal with the
bleed through? They used red or green on a page, it bled through the paper. so that you're reading this stuff and you get this weird ghostly reverse image of the next page, almost like a perverse spoiler.
Yes, yes, very strange.
Yeah, so that's effectively a droid really doing work.
Pretty much.
Wow. It is a real one. Yeah. A real literal artificial intelligence. And that's very hard to remove by people doing it, and incredibly expensive to do it. And quite frankly, we're working on some artificial intelligence techniques, cutting edge of science and all that, to actually clear up and clean up this comic book archive. And as you say, 600,000?
By linear measurements, right. About 600,000 pages of artwork.
That's a lot of pages.
And... Oh, so you're not counting them individually then?
No.
Well, the friend of mine that we got in to actually put it all up and catalogue it went a little bit bad after just a week, really, didn't he? Which is something. We're into the last 10 minutes.
Can I just quickly say, on a personal note, one of the things that excited me about this back catalogue was Crazy Comic, because I actually had a letter published in that when I was a kid. And I got one of those
postal orders?
Postal order for £5 in the post. I was so excited.
And years later, you now own the copyright of your letter again. So that's
I hope so.
We're down to the last few minutes. So I'm going to ask you one last question, and then we'll move to questions from the audience. There's lots of exciting things going to happen over the next few years. We've got this massive archive. Hopefully there are things happening in the future with games and TV and film and whatnot. How are we still going to make sure that this thing is still at the heart of what we do? Because I think with so many things happening, so many exciting things, lots of plans, how are we making sure that this stays as strong as it has been over the last 15 years?
Well, if we've got anything to do with it, and we have, that's that always will remain the core is the weekly comic, and Judgment Magazine is supportive of that, and I think that's very important as well. But at the core of it, fundamentally, is 2000 AD. I'm also very proud of what it does to encourage new talent, new writers. It kicks people's careers off as well in a really good way, and they all get nicked by Marvel and DC and have to then draw superheroes for the rest of their lives. But I think a lot of people love the opportunity to get their stories and their artwork seen by a big audience. But 2000 AD, and now we're digital, physical is important as well, and that won't ever go away if I've got anything to do with it. But digital is increasingly important for us because we can reach a whole audience out there. There are a whole world of people that actually deserve to experience 2000 AD. And when they discover it for the first time and they realize there's quite a few years of back catalogues to catch up on, that would be a wonderful experience. I mean, imagine discovering 2000 AD for the first time now and realizing how much cool stuff you've got to read. All those classic adventures that you haven't yet experienced. That would be brilliant. I'd love that.
Can I just add one thing? And you'll get a chance to hear him speak later on another panel. But I think one of the crucial things decisions that Chris and Jason took was to get Matt Smith and promote him to the editor 15 years ago. And 15 years in, Matt has been the longest serving Tharg of all time. And I don't think you can understate his importance to keeping the comic as fresh and as vibrant as it is.
Matt's work ethic is absolutely astonishing. He's very talented. He's very quiet about it, as any of you have heard him speak. He doesn't chat as much as I do, for example. But he absolutely enjoys his job and absolutely focuses entirely on delivering that charge of thrill power every week. And he's to be applauded by all of us because he just gets on with it. He's absolutely brilliant. He just chugs along doing stuff, dealing with all the things he has to deal with on a day-to-day basis, and maintaining his sanity while looking into the future. So he's brilliant.
And he's calm.
And he's very calm as well, yes, yes.
Well, he did stride out. We went to press on the 40th anniversary issue, which is out on the 22nd of February. And he on that day, he strode out and went, just put two comics out to press, 80 pages in total. I'm going home. All right, then. Yeah. So we're down to the last few minutes. Does anybody have any questions?
Are we passing?
One of the reasons for success for 2000 AD is it's been said it's grown up with us. But with declining readership of kids, young children and comics and so on, how are you going to make sure that it's still relevant to them so that they're here for the next...
I think that's where digital comes in. I'm very used to reading on paper. I also read digitally as well. But I'm not a what we call a digital native. I haven't grown up with a touchscreen, automatically assuming I have a touchscreen. Kids these days will just assume that. So the idea of getting something on paper for them is probably quite old school. I'm sure there'll be a few of them, and there'll be a few of them connecting vinyl as well and that kind of stuff. But it'll be because it's retro. But the digital offering, I think, is increasingly important for that. Have we got interference going on here?
It's the live draw next door.
Right, okay, cool.
Soon to be not live.
Well, one thing I'd also say about attracting younger readers is 2000 AD has aged up demonstrably over the years. And weekly comics don't exist for kids anymore. There are bad comics, there's SpongeBob, there's one or two other things, but they're all tied to a franchise, they're all tied to a TV series, they're all tied to a movie. And that is just the market as it is now. And where younger readers find comics is in the bookstores, or they get given them the rest of it. And that's the most important thing for us, is that we're a massively vibrant book publisher and not just a comic book publisher. And so getting our books in the right places to be discovered, to, you know, indicating where people to come in, where they can start. Doing things like the Hachette part work that we've got for Judge Dredd, giving people different ways in to our content and making sure we're in lots and lots of different channels. That's how we're going to build the new readers for the future.
It's also worth noting that the habit of weekly comics doesn't really exist anymore. You know, if you were reading 2000 AD at the start, you were probably already reading Action or Battle or any of the humor titles. So you were used to getting your pocket money every week and going down the newsagents and buying it. Kids don't do that. The nearest newsagent that stocks comics near me is about a mile away. So I think the books, essentially trade waiting, is the way to get. That's how I got my nephews, young nephews, into comics and the Phoenix as well, which is very good.
The Phoenix is particularly good. That's quite good. It's nice to see that kind of stuff. But yes, I think it's outreach as well. it's teaching people about comics and how to read them, and it has actually a skill to read comics. You'd be surprised. We all take it for granted we can read comics, but for a lot of people, especially if they haven't grown up with it, it actually takes a little bit of concentration to work out that you actually combine looking at the picture and the words at the same time. And for a lot of people, they read the words and they've completely not looked at the pictures. You can see them doing it. It's just really strange.
Another question. Yes, sir. Right there. You need this, don't you? Yeah. That's right.
I can give you a good example of the digitized way of things. I live in Stockholm now. So I used to read 2000 AD a lot when I was younger, and now, of course, you've got me back into it by doing the digitized side of things. So it does work. And
that's
of course,
great. My
children are now following, so it works.
Fantastic. It's good to know.
The question I've got is on the big media stuff, the film and TV side of things. You mentioned that movies are tough to do because of the contract side of things. But what about the Netflix equation? Those guys seem to be more into the independent filmmakers, give more creation.
Yes, I mean, there are lots of different ways of getting things made and seen. And that's something we're looking at the moment. What you have to have is something other than a desire to make a Strontium Dog TV show. You know, you actually have to have script and you have to have a structure around it. So these are the things we're looking into, how to approach those markets. But yes, you're right, it's actually quite exciting. There are non-traditional ways to go for visual media, movies and TV, very much so.
I'll say it. So would you have a countenance actually going into other media forms like television and doing it under your own, or is that just too hard?
That's more or less a repeat question. Yes, absolutely. TV and film stuff is important to us. It actually helps outreach to get people back in to read the comic as well. Because a lot of people, their media, the only thing they experience in media, it was social media and or TV. And it might even be streaming, not even TV, not even broadcast TV. It might be things like Netflix.
I mean, just to kind of touch on the point that you made there, as part of keeping control over these characters and these series, we're doing as much as possible in-house, aren't we? So the people who are working on this stuff are actually based in the office.
There is development going on within the studio of ideas, and we need to take them to a stage where we can then take them out to the big wide world. So I'm not going to give details here because we don't know which ones are going to work yet, but that we are putting funds and money into building stuff up now. So
I think it's fair to say we're alive to all opportunities.
We are indeed, yes. But we are, I just need to protect what we do. You know, we could have licensed dozens of things dozens of times and we'd have got dozens of loads of crap. And I just owe it to you and to me to not make rubbish stuff or not make stuff that's misunderstood by the people that are licensing it. And to a certain extent, we are quite a British institution. And to a certain extent, the North American film and TV people don't experience 2000 AD in the same way. I've been asked what Judge Dredd's superpower is. Many times. Can he fly? Yeah, he can if he's in a vehicle that lets him fly. You know, can he shoot laser rays? Yes, if he's got a laser gun or something like that. Yeah, yeah. Is he a mutant?
Well, on that note, we have run out of time, so put your hands together for Chris, Jason and Ben.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that, Earthlitz. Sorry about any sound issues. This was, of course, being recorded in front of a live audience. So not everybody's microphone technique is perfect. But I hope you at least got the gist of this panel. An absolutely fascinating insight into the behind-the-scenes work that goes on in creating the galaxy's greatest comic. Join us next week for a regular episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, and make sure you tune in 2 weeks' time for another amazing panel from the 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. Splendig Vertrig.
Dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000 AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline and follow on Instagram at Insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down!